Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good morning, everyone. I mean, good evening, sorry. You can see the days are getting all mixed up together. Good evening, everyone. Tonight, our speaker is Brenda. And I think most of you know Brenda. Brenda's been with us for a really long time. Brenda, do you have a title for today's talk?
So the title of the talk is, Who Are You Really? You could have a double title, which would be authenticity. So that's what we will be exploring. So who are you really? It seems kind of a funny question. But when you really think about it, it gets a little bit complicated. We're someone at work. We are someone at home. We're someone in the Zendo. We're someone on Zoom. We're someone all alone in the privacy of our own psyches. So who is the real Brenda? Will she please stand up? Now, coronavirus has accentuated this question for many of us. As we see our work identities, sometimes our jobs themselves, our family, our personal lives, sometimes our very lives, washed away in a short time by circumstances beyond our control. Many of us either have had that happen to us or have known many people who that has happened. And it's an interesting thing, I think, that we're all asking this question, both personally and collectively, at around the same time. Now, in psychological research, there's something called a default mode network, which is, strangely enough, I was very thrilled when I sort of found this. I thought, this is so cool. It's what your brain does when you're not engaged in any specific activity. So when you're writing or reading or cooking, your brain will use certain parts of your brain. But when you think you're doing nothing, your brain has other ideas. It's actually doing something. And it's doing this default mode network. Now, and this changes. It changes in response to various interventions, you know, in medicine, physical therapy changes the DMN. Acupuncture certainly changes the DMN in different ways. And meditation, strangely, changes the DMN. It actually kind of shrinks it a little bit, which is interesting. So we don't know, you know, what that means, really. What is our authentic self? What is it? Is it being hard at work? Is it changing all the time? Is there such a thing as an authentic self? And if so, how do you work with it? Even if it is changing, which is what Buddhism tells us, that things are constantly changing. As Fabio, who used to come some years ago to meditate regularly, he used to say, "You sit down on the cushion and then the show begins." And you know what? It might be different each day. Impressions from the day, plans, memories, longings, all pile in at the start of meditation. But then something else happens also. After a few minutes, our spine lengthens and readjusts. You might shift your position a bit. As we settle into the meditation, sometimes our breath settles down to a peaceful rhythm, or sometimes barely there at all. So there's a physical element also, something that's happening. During the sewing of the rakusu, a traditional garment prepared for ordination, a traditional square is made of many smaller patches in a very particular pattern that requires detailed attention. And I have it here, but I don't think you can see it very well. Let's see. Yep. Yeah. Little tiny patches, many, many, many little thousands of sutures in there, hiding in there. And many of us noted that when we were tired or distracted, we might be unable to sew for a period of days, months, or even years sometimes. At other times, the stitches would flow smoothly without any difficulty and just seem easy. Like, why don't I do this more often? And I know some of us have that same feeling. So how do you know if something or someone is being authentic? These are some thoughts that I have. I don't feel like I'm the authority on authenticity, and I will be asking all of you to contribute to this discussion. So you can start preparing now. I'll give you some of my thoughts. An authentic encounter needs nothing else. It has this element of standing complete by itself. It feels fulfilling, like after a good meal. It feels delicious. It's like just, right, complete. It has no agenda. It might feel that you have discovered something that neither person knew before. Maybe that didn't even exist before. A kind of magic. And it often, you know, resonates later into our daily life. It's kind of like a ringing of a bell and it resonates into space long after the ringing, the hit has happened. It's radiating into space, radiating to nowhere really. And an element of time, presence, attention, a meeting of minds. So it's timeless in a way. Something has changed. Those are sort of some of the things that I think of. Some of the experiences that I think had that flavor for me, I will describe a little bit. For example, the story of Buddha in the flower sermon, handing a flower to Maka Kashyapa. You know, there's no words that needed to be said. It was complete in itself. Some years ago, my initial meeting with Les, he introduced himself after the meditation. I was a young medical student at the time. And I was like, what am I doing here? What's going on here? And then he cocked his head. He said, I'm Les. And he kind of tilted his head a little bit to one side. I don't know if you remember this, Les. And he looked at me again and said, I think we're going to work together. I thought, what is this guy talking about? I said, okay, I didn't say anything. Okay, I walked away thinking, what possibly could he mean? More recently, many of you have heard me share stories about William, my grandson. I highly recommend being a grandmother or an aunt or an uncle if you can find that opportunity. You get a front row seat to the development of a human being. So about a week ago, I was walking with William, holding him in the park. I glanced at him, and it was so cold that I was just holding, carrying him. He wasn't in the stroller. I glanced at him, and his eyes were fixed on something up above. And I looked where he was looking, and he was looking at an airplane flying overhead. And he was just fascinated with this thing. Like he was just, he was completely transfixed with this airplane. I just looked at him looking, and then he stopped looking. He looked at me, and he understood immediately that I knew that he was seeing that airplane, like that we were looking at it together. We shared that moment. I mean, he didn't have any words yet. He's only 10 and a half months old. But he looked at me, he knew, and his face relaxed. His eyes softened, and he smiled a big smile, like, you get it, don't you? You know, that is cool. And, you know, no words were needed in that moment. My last story, a few of you know, a few weeks ago, I had a false positive test, COVID, probably was a false positive. I don't know for sure. It was around Christmas time. I usually check myself before, after I spend a few days on service, just to make sure before I re-engage with anybody outside of the hospital setting. And they call me and they're like, well, you have a positive test. And this was like 2 days before Christmas. So instead of seeing my family at Christmas, I spent the Christmas in the shed with the dog, thinking, okay, well, here, let the show begin. I don't know. We'll find out what happens. Am I going to die? Am I going to get sick? I'm like, okay. I took some juice with me and a few things to eat, so I didn't have to bother anybody, and off I went. And it was a very interesting moment, and I'm very grateful for it for many reasons. All the, you know, avoidance, discomfort, anticipation was all there. You know, all this, we've been working so hard to not have it. That it was like, now I just sit and wait it out. See, whatever happens, happens. Just hang on, you know. And all by myself for the next 7 days, I waited with the dog. Nothing happened. I didn't get a fever. I didn't get nothing. I was one of those lucky people, maybe, if I was either that or it was a false positive. Eventually, I got the courage up to retest multiple times, and I was negative. So I was very fortunate. And we'll never know. But for me, in this COVID crisis, it was a moment of true authenticity, because I got to come to grips with all of my thoughts and impressions over the past year, and also really experience kind of how isolating it is to have this illness for people, where you really can't see anybody, you know, and it's very hard to relate to somebody who has it, because people don't know what that feels like. There should be a COVID support group or something. maybe there is. I haven't looked into it. Now, I just wanted to kind of look into the word a little bit, authentic. And I'm, as some of you know, I'm a bit of a nerd. So I looked at the Greek history, you know, history of meaning of the word, and it's, it comes from auto, which is self, and hentes, which is, interestingly, both doer and being. So in Greek, apparently, they didn't make a distinction between doing and being. It was doing being, which is Dogen's favorite thing. And then in Proto-Indo-European, going further back, it comes from the word sene, which, or sne, S-N-E-H, or S-E-N-E, and which means to work on, to achieve. And it's also related to the Latin for nervous, nerve. My research took me to another interesting source, which was a fellow named Christopher Connors. He is a self-help coach. But he came up with a definition for authenticity, which says, authenticity is about presence, living in the moment with conviction and confidence, and staying true to yourself. An authentic person puts the people around them at ease, like a comforting old friend who welcomes us in and makes us feel at home. Then he quotes somebody else, Brené Brown. To be authentic, we must cultivate the courage to be imperfect and vulnerable. We have to believe that we are fundamentally worthy of love and acceptance, just as we are. I've learned that there is no better way to invite more grace, gratitude, and joy into our lives than by mindfully practicing authenticity. And he comes up with the five characteristics of being authentic. Right. Anything that has numbers sort of sounds Buddhist to me, so I was into that. And he says, number one, be true to yourself. Number two, think inward and look outward. Number three, treat people with kindness and respect. Number four, live in the moment and be a great listener. Number five, open-mindedness and fairness to opportunities and people. Now, one of the problems that happens sometimes with these authentic moments is that we tend to want to hold on to them. There's something in us that says, gosh, that was so sweet. That tasted so good. I want to kind of hold on to that moment. And sometimes often we hold on to those moments in our lives, maybe a little too long. We long for that beautiful time when everything fell away and want to somehow bring them back. But our tradition teaches us that although those moments are indeed special, we need to let them, even them, go in order to be able to meet the present moment that is awaiting our full attention. As it says in the Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, attributed to Dongshan of the Song Dynasty, "But even though the basis is reached and the approach comprehended, true eternity still flows." So I would like to close here and invite you to share of your own authentic experiences and some of the lessons you gleaned from these moments or how you were changed by them. Thank you.
Thank you, Brenda. We're now open for questions. Dave.
Thank you for your talk, Brenda. So many interesting things that you said, but early on, I was struck by your reference to the default mode network and how you found that so fascinating. I share that feeling. I ran across the idea of the default mode network several years ago when I was utterly fascinated, and I just wanted to compare notes with you a little bit about what you think about it. From the little that I've read about it, it seems to me that it has a strong correlation with that persistent inner monologue that we have all the time, over and over, churning through our heads, telling ourselves these stories about who we are. The thing that I always think of as an analogy to that is that it's a little bit like an actor running lines, you know, learning a character. You're practicing being your small self by having the default mode network run that script through your head over and over and over again. And it's only when you can quiet that that you can see past the multifaceted little collection of identities that are your small self. I just wonder what you think about that.
Yes, I agree with you. I think, and I'm fascinated by it. I think it's probably connected to acquiring language. Like, I'm not sure a baby probably has much of it before they don't know who they are. Like, you just see them kind of blindly walking around the world, you know, just bumping into things and just like, you know, it's fascinating. So I think we probably need to have somewhat of a functioning one to be able to work in the world, to negotiate sort of like a GPS, you know. How do I get to work? If you don't have the map, then it might be kind of hard. Every day to have to figure it out from scratch, you know? But at the same time, I think that if we start to believe we are that map, and we start being unable to change the map, then we start missing the moment. Then we're somewhere else. We're not here. We're somewhere else, you know. So I think it kind of has this sort of dual consciousness where you're like, okay, I know what the map says. It's kind of like hiking through the woods, you know. Okay, the map says in about a mile and a half, I should hit something, a cabin or something. But in the meantime, I'm just going to keep, you know, paying attention to what's in front of me. Something like that.
Mm-hmm. Your statement about babies before they can speak and what does that have to do with the default mode network reminds me of something that came up. I don't know how well you know my wife, Suzanne, but she is, in Jungian terms, a flaming extrovert, and I am, of course, an introvert. So we have a very interesting sort of relationship around. There's a saying that I always find very interesting about extroverts, which is, How do I know who I am until I see what I say?
Yes. Very interesting. Yes. Yes. Yeah. And I don't know, is there an equivalent for introverts?
Well, I don't know, but it just sort of suggests what you were saying, that before babies develop language, maybe their default mode network isn't quite the same kind of monologue that it is for us grownups.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's interesting. And I feel a little guilty creating that DMN in him. Like, I feel like I'm signing you up for a life of suffering, poor little baby, by teaching you to speak. But I'm very sorry. So, what are the alternatives?
That's right. Anyway.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Binary?
Thank you, Brenda. I was struck by that authentic false positive that you mentioned. And so we're obviously embodied creatures, and things that happen to our embodied selves can be highly authentic. I'm thinking of the time I broke my femur and I found myself lying on the ground, and it was a very clean break. And my left leg wasn't moving at all. And it, actually, 12 hours later, thanks to modern medical techniques, I had 23 inches of titanium in my leg, and I was on my way to mending. And, you know, most people were, I have a friend who's a motorcyclist, and he's actually 60, no, he's in his 70s now, but he's still going on 17. And in his youth, he felt he had so many accidents that he used to, on his motorcycles, he'd open up his eyes and figure out which ER he was in. And his take was, Dainuri, this is great, because you'll learn so much from this experience. And darn if he wasn't right, because it was really kind of, it's paradoxically joyful to realize that there were these processes that were going on that were healing, and I really just didn't have to do a lot other than show up and do the physical therapy and the things like that. And I'd like to get your sense, because you're I saw a really kind of extremely shocking segment on PBS News tonight about some of the COVID things that are happening, including people who are experiencing really these prolonged symptomatics. And you know, for me, I was, the good news was that a year later, I was like 95% recovered. And so I could kind of muse about it and how nice it was. But I just wanted to get your take on that element of authentic encounters with just this powerful mysterious force that is the pandemic, and how it manifests in people's lives and your life and what you've seen.
Yeah. I think for me, looking back at sort of the last year, what really is the most remarkable is our meeting with the unknown, that we're continuously meeting the unknown for the whole year. Like, what's going on? Nobody really knows, right? We know a few things, and then there's like this little tiny bit that we know, and then there's this whole bit that we don't know. And it's been an exercise, which is a tough exercise, a practical exercise, in maintaining our equanimity in the face of the unknown. I think that is really what I see more than anything. In us and all of us, you know, in this group, and we're probably, maybe we have a little bit more experience than many other people in terms of sort of sitting with the unknown, literally and figuratively. And I think that's the real tough thing. Like, maybe it's something, maybe it's nothing. Maybe the vaccine is a cure and maybe it's not. You know, maybe you won't get sick or maybe you will. Maybe you won't give anybody COVID after you get vaccinated, or maybe you will. So it's just been such a sobering thing on every front. It's like, whatever the knowledge is now, a month from now, it'll be something different. And yet, you know, the other part of it, the second part of it for me, is that's kind of clearly emerging more and more, is we are going to get through this. Like, everybody is like, you know, the human determination and the kind of the chutzpah, you know, the kind of the strength is coming out too. Yes, we're sick of it. Yes, but we are going to get through this. And as a human race, as a, you know, world, as nation, and, you know, and I think that to me that resilience is really, I'm really seeing that more and more. You know, yes, there's many, many difficulties, and yes, many people are dying, but we will figure out how to take care of ourselves as best we can.
Well, thank you. And I guess the essence of it is the encounter with the unknown is this authentic experience. And yet there's this, you know, there's obviously such a huge tragic element in it as well.
Thank you for sharing. Brenda? I just really quickly want to thank you so much for your work in the healthcare sector, and to acknowledge like the sacrifices that our healthcare workers are making for the rest of us. And like your description of spending Christmas alone in a shed with a dog, you know, like, and I'm sure, and many are affected a lot worse too. And so I just really respect your work. And respect also how encouraging and positive you are, even though you're really on the front lines of this. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Chris?
Thank you, Brenda, for the talk. I feel a little bit in a fog. I'm not sure, maybe it's because I'm a little sleepy, but so I'll try my best to make sense of this. So. Authentic, to be authentic is a kind of a tricky word. How many people would say they're not really authentic? Probably not very many. Or even if you think back in your own history, and you might look back, when 20 years ago when I did this, that was so ridiculous or stupid. Was it inauthentic? It was like what you were doing then, you know, it was your authentic self, even if it was diluted, you know. So is, you know, maybe that's a question I'll toss back to you, since I'm not sure I can think straight enough to do this. So if you're acting under delusion, of course, then it raises the question, what is delusion? But if you're acting under delusion, are you being authentic or inauthentic?
You know, I think that's an excellent question. And I think that, you know, my sense is that authenticity is kind of an inner sense that I'm acting out of my best intention or my, you know, I've thought about it, I've tried to gather the data and I'm putting this out there, you know, whatever that it is. And so I'm putting my best foot forward. That's authentic, is that I'm doing the best I can, or I've, you know, due diligence. Now, that may be totally wrong. You know, that may be from the point of view of somebody else who has superior insight, knowledge, expertise. You're like, really? You know, you did that? Okay. So it is, yeah, just because, you know, I think I'm being authentic does not mean that I'm doing the right thing by any means. You know, I don't think that that's the case. I think what does happen is that, you know, when you put forth an authentic effort, that your time falls away. There's something magical that happens there. You know, there's something that when you're like, if you're an athlete in the zone, anybody who's, you know, knows that when you're just fully in the zone, you're not doing it for anything else. There's no other agenda. You're just trying to do whatever that thing is that you've set out to do. And there's nothing else. You're not trying to impress somebody. You're not trying to prove a point. You're not doing it for somebody. You're just in it. And that's where I think the you know, true eternity still flows.
Good. Thank you. That's very nice. I like that.
Thank you. Great question.
Vanessa.
I was actually thinking about, well, what kind of helps authenticity to arise, or when does it most easily arise? And I was kind of thinking, well, it sort of seems to be in extreme situations, right? Like, I was very authentic, I think, in childbirth, for example. You know, like in the kind of like when you're in a situation where there's just no space for second thoughts, you know, where just like there's an immediacy of response. And you know, I think people when they're in pain, when we're in grief, there's an authenticity and that kind of vulnerability that we have when we're in deep grief. So I was just thinking about how, like, you work in a hospital, and I imagine in that situation, you must encounter people like in some of their most painful and vulnerable moments. And I suppose in some sense, some of their most deeply authentic moments as well. So I guess my question is, you know, how is that for you? You know, how do you hold that, and how does it relate to your practice? I'm assuming having that experience on a daily basis.
Yeah. You know, I think we all do a little bit. You know, we all have, you know, families. That's another place where authenticity, you know, reaches into. I was getting annoyed with my mother-in-law, and she like looks at me. She's like, you know, you don't really look like a Zen monk right now. You're driving me crazy. So she just wanted to point that out. Yes, we see people. Yeah, exactly. I do think that the extremes of physical pain or suffering or uncertainty, those sorts of things bring out our an authentic reaction. How do we sit with it? One of the things actually somebody taught me fairly recently is to sometimes, you know, the medical tendency is you're taught to hold people's experience, to hold it. And actually, that's physically not probably very good for you, because you kind of, if you look at older physicians, they're all hunched over and they're all kind of like, you know, they're carrying this huge burden. And so now what the psychology teaching has changed a little bit to, you are holding a container for them to have the experience. You want to hold that safety. But so you're holding that container, but you're not holding their experience. You're witnessing their experience. And I think that's probably in chaplaincy. I think you probably, I bet you they talked about that a little bit too. And in terms of, so you're a witness, you're seeing them. I see you, I see what you're going through, and I'm here to do my very best to help you. You know, but there was a period, I think my first 10 years, some of you have heard me talk about the first 10 years, I was really carrying it. And it was exhausting. It was really exhausting because I kept trying to change people and they wouldn't change. I was like, you know, you need to stop doing this. You need to stop doing that. You need to do this other thing. And they'd be like, yeah, sure. Yeah, whatever. And they show up, and especially teenagers. I treat a lot of teenagers. We all know how successful, you know, having inducing change in teenagers can be, right? And so I just got frustrated and I was so burned out. And then I learned about the wonderful thing called motivational interviewing, right? Some of you know this. And the psychologists in the audience. And you're like, okay, nobody will change until they want to change. And then they'll change in the way that they want to change. So really what you can do is you present options and you can present, you know, here's what I see. And you can be present for them for that moment that they actually do want to change, which may happen. So you can invite them, you can be present for them, but you cannot change anybody. So for me, that was a big turning point, which significantly decreased my own personal suffering. And I started realizing that. It's kind of like a revelation, like, wait, you're not changing anybody. You're just here for them.
Nick?
Can Vanessa please introduce her cat? Thank you.
Talking about authentic beings. Esme Octavia. He likes to go wherever my attention is. She likes to get between me and my object of attention. That's what she does.
You're really sweet.
She's kind of floppy right now.
Thanks, Vanessa.
Thank you.
Giuseppe?
Hello, can you hear me?
Hi, Giuseppe.
I try to share also a thought given Brenda's invitation on authenticity. First of all, so great. It's always so stimulating to be here with all of you, because I know that we are all thinking about the same mysteries. And authenticity for me is related to our identity. We can feel our identity, you know, our everyday identity is someone is a doctor, someone is an engineer, someone is a mother or a grandmother or a student. And and so we need to be... the authenticity necessarily is this effort of being faithful to our everyday identity. And at the same time is also authenticity is also being faithful to a larger identity, and not being stuck into a small everyday identity, but not from necessarily a practical point of view of like not wanting to be the grandmother or the engineer or whatever in that moment, but surely being connected with everybody, you know, and with a larger perception of reality. So now authenticity has got these two legs that makes it very I think continuous challenge. You continuously need attention, otherwise you fall on one leg or you fall on the other leg. And yes, so that's my thought. I fell on one leg yesterday, I sprained my ankle. Good.
Yeah, thank you.
And so this is my consideration. My question would be that so do you also see in authenticity these two authenticity to this two aspects, authenticity to the Brenda who is a doctor, authenticity to the Brenda who wants to see a larger universe and everybody.
For sure. Yeah, that's it. I think that you said that very well. I like that image of the two legs. It's beautiful. In terms of your commitment, and also your freedom to respond in the moment. You know, if you're leaning too much one way or the other, then you're going to be off balance. And to remember your commitment, even while you're responding to the moment, you know, that's a beautiful way of putting it. Thank you, Giuseppe.
Thank you.
Teresa.
Thank you, Brenda. I really enjoy your talk and the discussion. Your talk is related to something that I've been thinking a lot lately. And recently, I read a poem by this Vinicius de Moraes, who was a Brazilian poet and one of the fathers of Bossa Nova. He also wrote a lot of the Bossa Nova songs. And in one of his songs, in Portuguese, of course, he said, "A vida é a arte do encontro," which means life is the art of the encounter. And I don't know exactly what he meant by that, but when I read it, I said, yes, that's what life is about. Life is about meeting each moment. I think you talk about that today, meeting each moment. And if you meet each moment, you're always authentic. And then I thought, well, our practice prepares us to master that art, the art of the encounter. You know, you were saying today that many times we kind of hold on to those authentic moments. And sometimes also we are not able to meet those moments. We want, or at least I should talk by myself. Sometimes I feel, where is the instructions here? Let me check, what do I need to do in this moment? So yeah, for me, being authentic is just flowing from one moment to the other, which can be a little bit scary sometimes, because it's like, you know, working on a circus, like on the, how do you call it, these guys who jump in the trapeze.
Yeah.
You have to trust there is a net that will hold you. So, thank you. I appreciate your talk. I don't really have a question, but this has been in my mind lately.
Yeah, that's beautiful. The art of the encounter. Thank you very much. I think that's. Sometimes, you know, all you can do is show up and hope, like Kathy was saying the other day, showing up is all you can do.
Right.
Thank you.
Umar.
Hi, Brenda. How are you?
I'm good, Umar. How are you?
You taking care of yourself?
I'm trying.
That's the most important thing. You have to take care of yourself, Rina. If you don't take care of yourself, you can't take care of other people. That's always an issue. Question, something clicked in my mind while you were talking about, you know, changing other people. And, I mean, I come from a South Asian subcontinent family, I'll put it that way. One of the things that I've seen is there is, you know, this whole thing about changing other people, there is a sense of ego underneath it. And that's what I see with people all the time, especially in my family. They're always trying to get the other person to change. And Les has always told me, it's like, you know, do what you can, but don't have any expectations. And that sort of, that teaching has stayed with me, and it works, because it's like when you let go of expectation if the person is going to change or not, it really changes the way that you really start to think about everything else. And recently I went back to this old book from, I think, the 1930s. It's called The Art of Selfishness. Yes, it's a very sort of deceptive title to it. And he keeps on repeating one line over and over and over again throughout the book, which is no self-sacrifice and no ego gratification. And I was thinking about that recently. I put it down and, you know, just like I'm reading it again. And because first time I read, I just blasted through it and didn't take it in. And now reading it, I'm taking it in. And what came to me was what he's saying is really no approval. So in this moment, when you're not trying to change anybody, you do what needs to be done, you take care of them, you do whatever can be done, you're putting out respect and you're getting respect in that moment, but you're not seeking approval. Mm-hmm. This whole idea that we have now with social media and people standing right next to famous people, because standing right next to famous people or doing what somebody famous has done or eating what they have eaten will, you know, make you feel better. It may not have the same effect, but everybody seems to be posing on social media thinking that, you know, this is going to get them eyeballs. And, you know, of course, there's advertising behind it, but it doesn't create respect. It just creates approval. And it's very hollow. That's what I've come to understand. It's like you drink Coke, right? I was talking to a friend and she just drinks Coke. She doesn't drink water. And I said to her, why? And so I'll come from the South and we drink Coke or we drink iced tea. So Coke just makes you thirsty, right? And if you keep on drinking Coke, you'll end up getting diabetes and you're taking in caffeine. You'll get your heart pumping real fast. You'll end up getting a heart attack. Right. So, I mean, that's a nice capsule right there, you know, to give yourself a heart attack and diabetes. It doesn't really quench the thirst, which water does. Mm. It is the most simplest thing in the world. It gives you respect. It gives you what you need, and it leaves you. You know, it doesn't, but it gives you a sense of satisfaction that your thirst has been quenched. Coke just keeps on making you keep on going and going and going and going. And it doesn't do anything. It leaves you hollow. Mm. And you got me thinking about that, because I was just thinking how trying to change anybody, it has a sort of an empty and hollow feeling too. It doesn't really, it's an ego hit.
Right.
It's an ego hit that we're getting ego, and it keeps on leaving empty. There's no, and when you do something for somebody and you just, like last said, just have no expectations if it will have an effect or not have an effect. That is real, I think, respect. And that's where respect comes from. It's that sense of that I did my best, I did what I could in that given moment, and I walked away. And whatever happens, happens. You know?
Yeah. I think you're right, Umar. And I think that's very hard for us to do. You know, you always want to do more. You always want to, like, because there's always more to be done. I feel like always often that's kind of one thing. I sometimes feel like you're not doing enough. You know, it's never enough, but it's never enough. You can't do, you know, well, this is a deeper conversation, but, you know, saving all sentient beings is a hard job. It's another lecture.
That's why in the hospital you have so many different people doing so many different shifts, because it's like one after the other, you know. The engine gives out after a little while if you keep it like that.
And maybe not all of them even want to be saved.
There you go. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brenda.
Thank you, Diane.
I liked what you shared about your grandson. Little children are so in the moment and so spontaneous and just so genuine. They don't know how to be anything else but that, right? Yeah. And I was thinking about one time you talked about language. My son, Chris, had a wonderful imagination, and he could spend hours in his room playing with his cards and his blocks and building things. And one day he was in his room talking to himself, and he said, "My mother is a mother. My mother is a nurse. My mother is a nurse mother." You know, it was like he was trying to figure out who I was and what my role was. And still, you know, I think that I have, through my life, been my role or my title or my doing. And it's rare when I just feel like, you know, that feeling of just flowing and naturalness and genuineness. Those kinds of feelings are rare. And how... can you describe again what it feels like for you when, or do you, maybe you don't even feel it when you're genuine, you're probably not observing, you're just being, you're just engaged, so fully engaged that you're not, maybe not even, you're not writing the script, in other words, you're just being and doing, right?
Right. I think that's certainly one key element. You're not writing the script. I think that's a big one. And I think another one in my experience is that you really have to slow down.
Mm.
That you really have to allow it. Allow. And I share your, you know, rushing around kind of energy and wanting to get stuff done and all that. And a lot of it. And so I have to, and I think with my kids, often I didn't do enough of that, I think. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to do more of it with the grandchild in terms of really slowing down. Like I don't take calls. I have my cell phone, but I don't look at it all day when you know. And if I'm tired, if he's awake, like if I try to rest, I'm just with William. Mm. And that makes a big difference, sort of focusing your energy, being single-minded, making time, slowing down.
Right.
and it starts to arrive.
Yeah, that's a good point, Brenda. Slowing down and then just allowing to be. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Sure. Well, thank you, Brenda, for a wonderful talk tonight.
Thank you.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.